So thank you, Jerome, and thank you, Claudine, for that introduction. And it's wonderful to be here at the Collège de France with so many old friends here. So my title doesn't make a lot of sense in a way. I mean, we want numbers to be what they... We want emotions to be what they are, I guess. But I took this from Dedekind, has this essay called What Are Numbers and What Should They Be? But I guess it's not wholly inappropriate because I think it's sort of unclear what the best way to categorize quasi-emotions is, and that can easily degenerate into a sort of uninteresting verbal dispute, which I want to avoid it being. So I'm going to try to inflect the discussion in a way which avoids that. And I guess perhaps I hope this will be helpful because this is the first talk. I'm going to talk about emotions, but I also want to talk about other things as well. So, I mean, this question about quasi-emotions arises for other states. So we don't just want to think about quasi-emotions. We want to sort of think of this in the context of a whole range of attitudinal states and get some kind of reflective equilibrium between what we say about all these things. So I'm going to talk about emotions, but about beliefs and desires as well. Okay, so just to remind you of the sort of two great moments in the history of quasi-emotions. So Colin Radford, back in the 70s, I think, had this essay on pitying Anna Karenina. Isn't it terribly strange that we do that? And sort of set this debate going. And he had a lot to say in that article, and lots of it's interesting and suggestive, but it has this sort of odd conclusion. So he says right at the end that it's all very complicated, but pitying Anna Karenina is one of a class of what he calls incoherent behaviours. And he gives other examples, like, you know, we're very familiar with this, you know, hit the tennis shot, is it going over? You rise up in order to make the ball go over the net. Now, you know, your rising up isn't going to do anything to help the ball. You don't think it's going to do anything to help the ball. If somebody asks you that, you say no, but nonetheless, you do that. And it's, I guess we can say that's the kind of incoherence in that. We're not able to stop ourselves. We're doing it as if we believed that it was going to do some good. But really, it's just... the Anna Karenina problem just isn't like that at all. It's just a completely unhelpful way of thinking about it because, you know, when I've done the helping the tennis ball over the net, so I'm very happy to say to you, yeah, that was completely crazy. I was just, you know, it was just a sort of a reflex or had no control over myself and certainly didn't think there was any rationality in it. But I think if you ask us about... whether we think it's rational to pity Anna Karenina, we probably struggle to give you a very convincing story about that. But I think, you know, we do think it's rational. It's not a kind of piece of magical thinking that's taken grip of us temporarily, and then we go back to our normal lives. We integrate these emotions into the rest of our effective and intellectual lives, and we want some kind of rational defense of them. So this seems to be an unhelpful approach. Then Ken Walton, later on in Fearing Fictions and elsewhere, says, well, actually, the solution is to think that we don't pity Anna Karenina after all. Why not? Well, fear and pity, emotions like that, require in a constitutive, not just a causal way, but constitutive way, they require beliefs, which are absent in the fictional cases. What is going on? Well, we quasi-fear them. Okay, so we quasi-fear the slime, we quasi-pity Anna, and so on through the emotions. Of course, he wants to say quasi-fear and quasi-pity are phenomenologically like fear and pity. They may be indistinguishable phenomenologically from those states, but quasi-fear is, according to him, not a kind of fear. In general, a quasi-F is not a kind of F. It's something else. He also wants to allow, I think he uses the words maybe here, so quasi-fear might be an emotion kind, he says. Quasi-pity might be an emotion kind, but it's not a kind of pity or a kind of fear. Okay, so that's where people, that was a sort of big moment, I think, when people started to think about quasi-emotions. And that's what I'm going to do here. But I want to talk about emotions in the context of other states as well. So in particular, propositional attitudes, beliefs and desires, because the same problem arises here. So, you know, we there's not much argument to the effect that there's not much argument concerning the proposition that we don't believe in Anna Karenina. What's going on? Well, you have a state which is belief-like in some ways, and which is about Anna Karenina, if we can make sense of that notion of being about a non-existent thing. And I'm bracketing that out. I'm not going to try and solve that problem here. People have their own answers to that. I'd just let you guys get on with that. And there's a fairly strong consensus, probably not 100%, that those states which are belief-like are imagining. So we imagine Anna, we imagine the things that she does. So not many people, possibly vanishingly small number of people, think that those belief-like states that we are happy to call imaginings are beliefs. That's not what most people think. We're happy to call them imaginings and say that imaginings and beliefs are different. But when it comes to desires, people's intuitions run somewhat contrary to that, I think. So I think many people, I haven't done any surveys here, and possibly that would be a useful thing to do, but my impression is that just from the literature on this, that many people, probably a majority, think that when it comes to desires concerning fictional things like desiring Desdemona not to be killed by Othello, these are genuine desires. I think that's the view that most people want to take here, that they're not just desire-like states, but they're genuine desires. And also when it comes to emotions, that emotions concerning fictional things, fear of the slime, pity for Anna Karenina, are genuine emotions. They may be different in various ways from the emotions that we feel in response to our family and other people really around us, but that doesn't stop them being emotions. They may be just a different kind of emotions, but we think of them as genuinely emotions rather than emotion-like. So there seems to be an asymmetry in people's intuitions about these cases. I mean, you might say, well, actually, look, I'm really not that sure about desires, whether they're whether the fictional ones are really desires or not. I'm really not sure about the emotion ones either. That's good enough for me to have the asymmetry, because I think that if you're in that position, you don't have probably a similar uncertainty about beliefs and imaginings case. You think it's just pretty clear that the imaginings are not beliefs, you know, that we really do not believe in Anna Karenina. Anyway, that's the asymmetry which I think I have noticed here. So you might say, well, look, okay, that's interesting. So does that tell us something about the relation between these three kinds of cases? So that the last two cases of what we might call X-like states are more different from the corresponding X states than the first cases. So that there's a bigger difference between beliefs and imaginings than there is between desires and quasi-desires and emotions and quasi-emotions. And that bigness of difference accounts for the asymmetry in our intuitions here. On the other hand, you might say, well, look, I just don't care about this. This is uninteresting. So people's intuitive responses here might just be uninteresting and not tell us anything. I mean, people think all sorts of strange things, and some of what they think just isn't worth taking seriously. Well, that's possible. I've no settled view about that. But I think, it's worth just taking cognizance of the possibility that this difference arises because people are sensitive in some way to differences between the cases, where they would struggle to actually articulate what those differences are. So, people can be sensitive to a difference without really knowing what the difference is. And that might be what's going on in these cases. And maybe the intuitive responses reflect those differences of sensitivity. So I think it's worth thinking about whether a philosophical theory can make sense of these intuitive responses by locating some difference between the cases which people are plausibly sensitive to. Okay, well, that's what I would like to do, but that's what I've failed to do. So that the sort of the conclusion of this is that I'm not going to be able to explain this asymmetry, but we'll take us a little while to get there. So here's a way that all three cases, beliefs, desires, emotions, in fictional contexts, differ from beliefs, desires, and emotions in real life, if you sort of take what I mean here. So beliefs, desires, and emotions all have what I'm going to call, and maybe this is just me imposing a bit of terminology here, rather than picking up on something that's already acknowledged out there. I mean, I think people use these phrases in different ways, but this is just a label here for the moment at least. So I'm going to talk about what I'm calling satisfaction conditions. Beliefs, desires, and emotions will have what I'm going to call satisfaction conditions. So the belief that P is satisfied when P. So the belief that it's raining is satisfied when it's raining. The desire that P is satisfied when P, so my desire that it rain is satisfied when it rains. And emotion, slightly more difficult category here, to do a little bit of work here and to make some assumptions about emotions, which I'm happy to make, but maybe not everybody would be. So I take it that emotions, or at least the class of emotions that we're going to be talking about here, are emotions which have representational content. So they represent their objects in certain ways. So fear represents its objects as dangerous, for example. So you might not think that the spider is dangerous, but your fear of the spider represents the spider as dangerous. So for me, an emotion is going to be satisfied when it represents its object as being a certain way, F, and that thing is that way. So, So those are satisfaction conditions for beliefs, desires, and emotions. And then, and that seems to make sense for ordinary kinds of cases when we're not involved in a fiction, when we're thinking about the real world. How does that work in fictional cases? Well, think about the case of belief. So here I go around telling people that I believe that Anna Karenina is unhappy. We do say those sorts of things. What's the satisfaction condition for this so-called belief of mine? Well, given what I've said, it ought to be that Anna is unhappy. That can't be right, because if it was, it couldn't be satisfied. There is not and could not be any Anna Karenina. She is a necessarily non-existent thing. That's another argument, but we can go back to that maybe, but I would certainly want to say that. So there's no Anna Karenina, necessarily there's no Anna Karenina. So what's really going on here? What ought we to say? Well, we ought to say that my belief, calling it a belief for the moment, is satisfied if it's part of the story that Anna Karenina is unhappy, which it is. It's part of the story that she's unhappy. So my belief is satisfied. So this belief, I'm now putting it in quotes, has an unusual satisfaction condition. It's not one which is an instance of the schema I just gave, the belief that P is satisfied if and only if P. Instead, it's an instance of the schema, the belief that P is satisfied if and only if it's fictional that P, which is different. So that's very different from an ordinary belief. In fact, we've already agreed, it's not really a belief at all, it's an imagining. So that difference rationalizes our decision to treat the Anna Karenina case as a case of imagining rather than believing, because it's a state with a very different kind of satisfaction condition. Beliefs have one kind of satisfaction condition. This state that we're talking about in the case of Anna Karenina has a different kind of satisfaction condition. So it seems perfectly appropriate to think of it as a different kind of state. And that's what we do. We think of it as an imagining. So everything seems to be right with the world. Our intuition here is underwritten by a theory about what the difference actually is. So go to desires. We can say similar things here. I go around telling you that I want Macbeth to be killed by the end of the play if we're discussing it in the interval. And we don't know yet what's going to happen. So I desire that Macbeth be killed. He is. So it seems my desire is satisfied. But again, that's not right. Macbeth isn't killed. He doesn't exist. Never did. And never possibly could, so he wasn't killed. my desire isn't satisfied. What, of course, is true is that it's fictional that Macbeth is killed. And that was surely enough to satisfy my desire. So we've been discussing it into the interval, and I say, I really want Macbeth to be killed. Well, if in the play by the end of the play he's killed. Surely that's enough. I don't want any more than that. I don't want the actor to be taken out and executed. So that's enough to satisfy my desire. So again, we've got a desire that Macbeth be killed, which is satisfied if and only if it's fictional in the play that he's killed. And again, that's a different kind of satisfaction condition that holds in this case. So with an ordinary desire, like the desire that it rain tomorrow, that's satisfied if it rains tomorrow. But my desire that Macbeth be killed is not like that. It's satisfied when it's fictional in the play that he's killed. So my desire that Macbeth be killed is, again, just as in the case of belief, importantly different from my desire, sorry, there's a misspelling there, that it will rain tomorrow, sorry. Okay. And Philippa, you'll tell me when I've got sort of 5 minutes. Okay, great. So someone, you know, it's a well-known objection to that way of thinking about it, which is to say, you've really just misdescribed what's going on in that case. I said my desire that Macbeth be killed is satisfied if it's fictional in the play that he's killed. And that's the wrong thing to say, according to the objection. And the right thing to say is my desire that it be fictional in the play that Macbeth be killed is satisfied if it's fictional in the play that Macbeth be killed. And that has exactly the same form as a standard satisfaction condition for desire. So my desire that it rain tomorrow is satisfied if it rains tomorrow. And we're back to symmetry between the fictional and the real cases. So the response to that is as follows. So I agree that my desire that it be fictional in the play that Macbeth be killed is satisfied if and only if it's fictional in the play that he's killed. I agree with that. That's a desire. It's a perfectly ordinary desire, like my desire that it will rain. But desiring that it be fictional in the play that Macbeth be killed and desiring that Macbeth be killed are not the same desire. Why not? Because you can have the one without having the other. So you desire Macbeth's death, but you think the play would be better without the death. You might take that view. Or you might like Macbeth and want him to succeed with his plans, but you think that actually the play would be a better play if he dies at the end of it. So what we have is two different kinds of desires, calling them both desires at the moment, which in the end, of course, I'm not wanting to do, with the same satisfaction conditions, very strange. The desire that Macbeth die and that it be true in the play that he dies are both satisfied by it being true in the play that he dies. That's very odd. Two different desires with the same satisfaction conditions. How could they be different? Well, they're different kinds of desires. And maybe we want to say, well, one really isn't a desire at all. Maybe we want to go the Walton way and say, Walton way with regard to desires here, and say that what we've been calling our desire for Macbeth to be killed isn't really a desire at all. I don't have a view about that. I think that's sort of a difficult question to answer. All I think about that is, so here's a sort of way of thinking about what kind of a question that is. So I think the following. So once we've agreed on how the two cases differ, And we have just discussed that, and I'm assuming you've agreed with me about that. Then we've agreed on everything that there is to talk about. There's nothing else to discuss. The answer to the question, are they both desires, supervenes on what we've agreed on so far. There isn't a separate question to answer. So the answer, if there is one, has already been settled once we've had that agreement. Of course, we may not know what the answer is, and I don't know what the answer is. But that's an epistemological question. The metaphysical question about what the answer actually is, I think, is given by our answer to the questions that we've already asked. This further question supervenes on those earlier issues. It may also be that there just isn't an answer. So that's also metaphysically a possibility. There's no answer to the question. But if that's the answer, namely that there's no answer, then that supervenes on what we've agreed on so far, and it's not a separate question to settle. Okay, so that's just a little aside there on where we can avoid this turning into a verbal dispute. We need to recognise when we've gone as far with the argument as we can. So go to the case of emotion. How much longer do I have?
15.
Okay, that's fine. Okay. So go now to the case of emotions, which is what we're here to talk about. Okay, so my fear of the polar bear, the one that's standing there in front of me right now, represents the polar bear as dangerous. Okay. And that polar bear is dangerous, and so my fear is satisfied in my sense of what it takes for an emotion to be satisfied. That doesn't mean that my fear is entirely appropriate. I mean, my fear might be paralyzing me and preventing me from running away, which would be a good thing. So there will be all sorts of ways in which my emotion might not be the best thing for me to be experiencing right now, but at least you can say about it that it is satisfied in my sense. Take a fictional case. My fear of Dracula represents him as dangerous. He isn't, because he doesn't exist. What is true, of course, is not that Dracula is dangerous, but that he is represented in the relevant fiction as being dangerous. So that, again, ought to be enough. If I'm watching the movie and I'm fearing Dracula, it ought to be enough to satisfy my emotion that Dracula is represented in that movie as being dangerous. And if this was a different kind of movie and Dracula was being represented in it as a kindly, caring sort of person, then my fearing Dracula in that case would not be satisfied. But because Dracula in this vampire film is represented as dangerous, my fear is satisfied. So that the case, again, is really just like the case of desire. So beliefs, desires, emotions all get the same treatment here. For all these kinds of states, the real life cases are significantly different from the fictional cases. And the difference for all three is just the same. The difference is in the different kinds of satisfaction conditions. So it looks as if we should answer the classification question for all three states in the same way. So what's the classification question? It's this one. are real life Fs, beliefs, desires, emotions, and fictional Fs, all really Fs, or are fictional Fs really just quasi Fs and not really Fs at all? But the puzzle that I started with and haven't offered you a solution to is that we have an inclination to answer these questions in different ways. In one way, for belief, thinking pretty confidently that beliefs and imaginings are different kinds of states, and that imaginings are not beliefs, they're not just a kind of belief, they're a different sort of state altogether. Somebody who imagines something in the relevant sense is not somebody with a special kind of belief, they're in an unbelief sort of state. And we have a different response when it comes to desires and emotions. I think most of us either think that the fictional desires are really desires and the fictional emotions are really emotions. Of course, there are differences between them, but they're really desires and emotions. Or we sort of waver on this. It just doesn't seem to us that there's a clear answer. So in the belief case, we're all, maybe it's nearly all, clear that the fictional cases are not really beliefs, they're imaginings. And in the desire and emotion cases, most of us, again, maybe not exactly clear what that means, don't have a strong sense that fictional cases are not really desires or emotions. So might there be other ways that the cases differ? Might there be other factors here that I haven't taken into account, which would explain the asymmetry in response, which I have so far failed to explain? Well, a couple of ways, I think, that, you know, no doubt there are lots of possible answers to that, and I'd be interested to hear somebody come up with one. But here are a couple that don't, I think, don't work. So one, well, you can point out some differences here. So surely, for instance, belief differs from emotion in the fact that beliefs are more directly connected to behavior than emotions are. That we think of beliefs as being drivers of behavior in certain kinds of rationally appropriate ways. So if we think about motivation in a human sort of framework, we think that rational motivation is a matter of having certain kinds of beliefs and desires and rational behavior following from that. And emotions is not really quite the same. So there's a much more messy connection between emotion and behavior. But that won't help us, because here belief stacks up with desire, because it's belief and desire that explain motivation. And so you'd have to put belief and desire in one category and emotion in another category, and that's not what we're trying to do. Another beginning of an explanation would be to say, well, look, think about desire now. Desires differ from emotions in that desire's satisfaction condition is not what you would call a condition of correctness. So we don't think of desires as correct or appropriate only if they're satisfied. On the contrary, I mean, if you have a desire and what you desire is satisfied, then you ought to cease having the desire. And emotions are, on the other hand, emotions being different from desires in this way are at least in one way incorrect if they don't represent their objects as they are. So that's the difference between belief, desires and emotions. But then emotion stacks up with belief, and again the asymmetry that we're looking to explain isn't explained. So we don't have an explanation of people's asymmetric treatment of the three cases. which separates belief from the other two kind, the other two cases, which is what we were looking for. So I failed.